trotted through the tunnel and up the long ramp into the fortress, then turned towards the courtyard, where Marshal Varouz would be waiting. All the while, Ardi was rubbing up against the back of his mind. It was hardly as though he had nothing else to think about. The contest was close now, very close. Soon he would fight before the cheering crowds, his family and friends among them. It might make his reputation, or sink it. He should have been lying awake at night, tense and sweating, worrying endlessly about forms and training and steels. And yet, somehow, that wasn't what he thought about in bed. Then there was a war on. It was easy to forget, here in the sunny lanes of the Agrant, that Angland had been invaded by hordes of slavering barbarians. He would be going north soon to lead his company in battle. There, surely, was a thought to keep a man occupied. Was not war a deadly business? He could be hurt or scarred or killed even. Giselle tried to conjure up the twisting, twitching, painted face of Fenris the Feared. Legions of screaming savages descending upon the Agrant. It was a terrible business, all right, a dangerous and frightening business. Ardi came from Angland. What if, say, she were to fall into the hands of the Northmen? Giselle would rush to her rescue, of course. She would not be hurt. Well, not badly. Perhaps her clothes a little torn, like so. No doubt she would be frightened, grateful. He would be obliged to comfort her, of course. She might even faint. He might have to carry her, her head pressed against his shoulder. He might have to lay her down and loosen her clothes. Their lips might touch, just brush gently. Hers might part a little. Then Giselle stumbled in the road. There was a pleasant swelling building in his crotch. Pleasant, but hardly compatible with a brisk run. He was nearly at the courtyard now, and this would never do at fencing practice. He glanced desperately around for a distraction, and nearly choked on his tongue. Major West was standing by the wall, dressed to fence, and watching him approach with an unusually grim expression. For an instant, Giselle wondered if his friend might be able to tell what he'd been thinking. He swallowed guiltily, felt the blood rushing to his face. West couldn't know. He couldn't. But he was most unhappy about something. "Lothar," he grunted. "West." Giselle stared down at his shoes. They had not been getting on too well since West joined Lord Marshal Burr's staff. Giselle tried to be happy for him, but could not escape the feeling that he was better qualified for the post. He had excellent blood, after all, whether he had experience in the field or not. Then Ardi was still lurking between them, that unpleasant and needless warning. Everyone knew that West had been first through the breach at Ulrioch. Everyone knew that he had the devil of a temper. That had always seemed exciting to Giselle, until he got on the wrong end of it. "Varouz is waiting." West unfolded his arms and strode off towards the archway. "And he's not alone." "Not alone? The Marshal feels you need to get used to an audience." Giselle frowned. "I'm surprised anyone cares in the present climate, what with the war and all." "You'd be surprised. Fighting and fencing and all things martial are very much the flavour. Everyone's wearing a sword these days, even if they've never drawn one in their lives. There's an absolute fever about the contest, believe me." Giselle blinked as they passed into the bright courtyard. A stand of temporary seating had been hastily erected along one wall, packed from one end to the other with people. 30 or more.
"And here he is!"
shouted Marshal Varouz. There was a ripple of polite applause. Giselle felt himself grinning. There were some very important people in amongst the crowd. He spotted Morovia, the Lord High Justice, stroking his long beard. Lord Isher was not far away from him, looking slightly bored. Crown Prince Ladislaw himself was lounging on the front row, shining in a shirt of gossamer chainmail and clapping enthusiastically. The people on the benches behind had to lean over to see round the waving plume on his magnificent hat. Farooz handed Giselle his steels, still beaming.
"Don't you dare make me look like a fool," he hissed.
Giselle coughed nervously, looking up at the rows of expectant people. His heart sank. Inquisitor Glockter's toothless grin leered at him from the crowd, and on the row behind him, Ardy West. She was wearing an expression that she never had in his daydreams, one-third sullen, one-third accusing, one-third simply bored. He glanced away, staring toward the opposite wall, inwardly cursing his own cowardice. He seemed unable to meet anyone's eye these days.
"This bout will be fought with half-edged steels," thundered the Lord Marshal. "The best of three touches."
West already had his swords drawn and was making his way to the circle, marked out with white chalk in the carefully shaved grass. Giselle's heart was hammering loud as he fumbled his own steels out of their sheaths, acutely aware of all those eyes upon him. He took his mark opposite West, pushing his feet cautiously into the grass. West raised his steels, Giselle did the same. They faced each other for a moment, motionless.
"Begin!" shouted Varouz.
It quickly became clear that West had no mind to roll over for him. He came on with more than his usual ferocity, harrying Giselle with a flurry of heavy cuts, their steels clashing and scraping rapidly together. He gave ground, still uncomfortable under the watchful eyes of all those people, damned important people, some of them. But as West pushed him back towards the edge of the circle, his nerves began to fade, his training took over. He ducked away, making room for himself, parrying the cuts with left and right, dodging and dancing, too fast to catch. The people faded. Even Ardy was gone. The blades moved by themselves, back and forth, up and down. There was no need for him to look at them. He turned his attention to West's eyes, watched them flicker from the ground to the steels, to Giselle's dancing feet, trying to guess his intentions. He felt the lunge coming, even before it was begun. He feinted one way, then turned the other, slipping smoothly round behind West as he blundered past. It was a simple matter for him to apply his foot to the seat of his opponent's trousers and shove him out of the circle.
"A touch!"
shouted Marshal Varouz. There was a ripple of laughter as the Major sprawled on his face.
"A touch on the arse!"
guffawed the Crown Prince, his plume waving back and forth with merriment.
"One to Captain Luther!"
West didn't look half so intimidating with his face in the dirt. Giselle gave a little bow to the audience, risked a smile in Ardy's direction as he rose. He was disappointed to see she wasn't even looking at him. She was watching her brother struggle in the dust with a faint, cruel grin. West got slowly to his feet.
"A good touch," he muttered through gritted teeth as he stepped back into the circle.
Giselle took his own mark, barely able to suppress his smile.
"Begin!"
shouted Varouz. West came on strongly again, but Giselle was warming to his task now. The sounds of the audience muttered and swelled as he danced this way and that. He began to work the odd flourish into his movements, and the onlookers responded, oohs and ahs, floating up as he flicked West's efforts away. He had never fenced so well, never moved so smoothly. The bigger man was starting to tire a little. The snap was going out of his cuts. Their long steels clashed together, scraped. Giselle twisted his right wrist and tore West's blade from his fingers, stepped in and slashed at him with his left.
"Gah!"
West winced and dropped his short steel, hopping away and grabbing his forearm. A few drops of blood pattered across the ground.
"Two to nothing!"
shouted Varouz. The Crown Prince jumped up, his hat tumbling off, delighted by the sight of blood.
"Excellent!" he squawked. "Capital!"
Others joined him on their feet, clapping loudly. Giselle basked in their approval, smiling wide, every muscle tingling with happiness. He understood now what he had been training for.
"Well fought, Giselle,"
muttered West, a trickle of blood running down his forearm.
"You've got too good for me. Sorry about the cut."
Giselle grinned. He wasn't sorry in the least.
"It's nothing. Just a scratch."
West strode away, frowning and holding his wrist. Nobody paid much attention to his exit, Giselle least of all. Sporting events are all about the winners. Lord Morovia was the first to get up from the benches and offer his congratulations.
"What a promising young man," he said, smiling warmly at Giselle. "But do you think he can beat Bremer Dan Gorst?"
Varouz gave Giselle a fatherly clap on the shoulder.
"I'm sure he can beat anyone on the right day."
"Have you seen Gorst fence?"
"No, though I hear he is most impressive."
"Oh, indeed. He is a devil."
The High Justice raised his bushy eyebrows.
"I look forward to seeing them meet. Have you ever considered a career in the law, Captain Luther?"
Giselle was taken by surprise.
No, Your Worship. That is, I am a soldier." "Of course you are. But battles and so forth can play hell with the nerves. If you should ever change your mind, perhaps I might have a place for you. I can always find a use for promising men."
Thank you."
"Until the contest, then. Good luck, Captain,"
he threw over his shoulder as he shuffled away. The implication was that he thought Giselle would need a great deal of it. His Highness Prince Ladislaw was more optimistic.
"You're my man, Lothar," he shouted, poking the air with his fingers as though they were fencing steels. "I'm going to double my bet on you."
Giselle bowed obsequiously.
"Your Highness is too kind."
"You're my man, a soldier. A fencing man should fight for his country, eh, Varouz? Why isn't this Gorst a soldier?"
"I believe he is, Your Highness," said the Lord Marshal gently. "He is a kinsman of Lord Brock and serves with his personal guard."
"Oh."
The prince seemed confused for a moment, but soon perked up.
"But you're my man," he shouted at Giselle,
poking once more with his fingers, the feather on his hat waving this way and that.
"You're the man for me."
He danced off towards the archway, decorative chainmail gleaming.
"Very impressive."
Giselle whipped round, took an ungainly step back, Glockta leering at him from his blind side. For a cripple, he had an uncanny knack of sneaking up on a man.
"What a happy chance for everyone that you didn't give it up after all."
"I never had any intention of doing so," snapped Giselle frostily. Glockta sucked at his gums.
"If you say so, Captain."
"I do." Giselle turned rudely away, hoping that he never had occasion to speak to the loathsome man again. He found himself staring straight into Ardi's face, no more than a foot away.
"Gah!"
he stammered, stepping back again.
"Giselle," she said, "I haven't seen you in a while."
He glanced nervously around. Glockta was shambling away. West was long gone. Varouz was busy holding forth to Lord Isher and a few others still remaining in the courtyard. They were unobserved. He had to speak to her. He ought to tell her straight out that he could not see her any more. He owed her that much.
Nothing to say to me.
He turned swiftly on his heel and walked away, his shoulders prickling with shame. The tedium of guard duty at the South Gate seemed, after all that unexpected excitement, almost a mercy. Giselle was quite looking forward to standing idly by, watching people file in and out of the Agriant, listening to Lieutenant Casper's mindless babble. At least, he was, until he got there. Casper and the usual complement of armoured soldiers were clustered around the outer gates, where the old bridge across the moat passed between the two massive, white-rendered towers of the gatehouse. As Giselle marched down to the end of the long tunnel, he saw that there was someone with them. A small, harassed-looking fellow wearing spectacles. Giselle recognized him vaguely. Morrow, he was called, some crony of the Lord Chamberlain.
He had no reason to be here.
Captain Luther, what a happy chance.
Giselle jumped. It was that lunatic Sulphur, sitting cross-legged on the ground behind him, his back against the sheer wall of the gatehouse.
What the hell's he doing here?
Snapped Giselle. Casper opened his mouth to speak, but Sulphur got in first.
Don't mind me, Captain. I'm simply waiting for my master.
Your master? He dreaded to think what manner of an idiot this idiot might serve.
Indeed. He should be here very shortly.
Sulphur frowned up at the sun.
He is already somewhat tardy, if the truth be told.
Really?
Yes.
The madman broke into a friendly smile once more.
But he'll be along, Giselle. You can depend on it.
First name terms was too much to take. He hardly knew the man, and what he knew he didn't like. He opened his mouth to give him a piece of his mind, but Sulphur suddenly jumped up, grabbing his stick from the wall and brushing himself down.
"Here they are,"
he said, looking out across the moat. Giselle followed the idiot's eyes with his own. A magnificent old man was striding purposefully across the bridge, bald head held high, a fabulous gown of shimmering red and silver flowing about him in the breeze. At his heels came a sickly-looking youth, head a little bowed, as if in awe of the older man, holding a long staff out before him in upturned palms. A great brute of a man in a heavy fur cloak followed behind them, a good half-head taller than the other two.
What the...
Giselle trailed off. He seemed to recognize the old man from somewhere. Some lord, perhaps, from the Open Council? Some foreign ambassador? Certainly he had an air of majesty. Giselle racked his brains as they approached, but could not place him. The old man stopped before the gatehouse, swept Giselle, Casper, Morrow, and the guards imperiously with glittering green eyes.
Yoru,
he said. Sulphur stepped forward, bowing low.
Master Bias,
he murmured in hushed tones of deep respect. And that was it. That was why Giselle knew the man. He bore a definite resemblance to the statue of Baez in the Kingsway. The statue Giselle had run past so many times. A little fatter, perhaps, but that expression, stern, wise, effortlessly commanding, was just the same. Giselle frowned. For the old man to be called by that name? He didn't like it. He didn't like the look of the lanky young man with the staff, either. He liked the look of the old man's other companion even less. West had often told Giselle that the Northmen found in Adua, usually skulking, dishevelled by the docks, or dirty drunk in gutters, were by no means typical of their people. Those that lived free in the far north, fighting, feuding, feasting, and doing whatever Northmen did, were of quite a different kind. A tall, fierce, handsome people, Giselle had always imagined, with a touch of romance about them. Strong, yet graceful. Wild, yet noble. Savage, yet cunning. The kind of men whose eyes are fixed always on the far horizon. This was not one of those. Never in his life had Giselle seen a more brutish-looking man. Even Fenris the Feared had seemed civilized by comparison. His face was like a whipped back, crisscrossed with ragged scars. His nose was bent, pointing off a little sideways. One ear had a big notch out of it. One eye seemed a touch higher than the other, surrounded by a crescent-shaped wound. His whole face, in fact, was slightly beaten, broken, lopsided, like that of a prize-fighter who has fought a few bouts too many. His expression, too, was that of one punch drunk. He gawped up at the gatehouse, forehead furrowed, mouth hanging open, staring about him with a look of near-animal stupidity. He wore a long fur cloak and a leather tunic set with gold, but this height of barbaric splendour only made him look more savage, and there was no missing the long, heavy sword at his belt. The Northman scratched at a big pink scar through the stubble on his cheek as he peered up at the sheer walls above, and Giselle noticed one of his fingers was missing.
as though any further evidence of a life of violence and savagery was necessary. To let this hulking primitive into the Agriont? While they were at war with the Northmen, it was unthinkable, but Morrow was already sidling forward.
"The Lord Chamberlain is expecting you, gentlemen,"
he gushed as he bowed and scraped his way towards the old man.
"If you would care to follow me."
"One moment." Giselle grabbed the Under-Secretary by the elbow and pulled him aside. "Him too?" he asked incredulously, nodding over at the primitive in the cloak. "We are at war, you know."
"Lord Hoff was most specific."
Morrow shook his arm free, spectacles flashing.
"Keep him here if you wish, but you can explain it to the Lord Chamberlain."
Giselle swallowed. That idea was not at all appealing. He glanced up at the old man, but could not look him in the eye for long. He had a mysterious air, an air of knowing something no one else could guess, and it was most unsettling.
"You must leave your weapons here," he shouted, speaking as slowly and clearly as possible.
"Happy to." The Northman pulled the sword from his belt and held it out. It weighed heavily in Giselle's hands, a big, plain, brutal-looking weapon. He followed it with a long knife, then knelt and pulled another from his boot. He took a third from the small of his back, and then produced a thin blade from inside his sleeve, heaping them into Giselle's outstretched arms. The Northman smiled broadly. It was truly a hideous sight, the ragged scars twisting and puckering, making his face more lopsided than ever.
"You can never have too many knives," he growled in a deep, grinding voice.
Nobody laughed, but he did not seem to care.
"Shall we go?"
asked the old man.
"Without delay,"
said Morrow, turning to leave.
"I'll come with you."
Giselle dumped his armload of weapons into Casper's hands.
"That really isn't necessary, Captain,"
whined Morrow.
"I insist."
Once he was delivered to the Lord Chamberlain, the Northman could murder whomever he pleased. It would be someone else's problem. But until he got there, Giselle might be blamed for whatever mischief he got up to, and he was damned if he was going to let that happen. The guards stood aside. The strange procession passed through the gate. Morrow was first, whispering obsequious nothings over his shoulder to the old man in the splendid robe. The pale youth was next, followed by Sulphur. The nine-fingered Northman lumbered along at the back. Giselle followed with his thumb in his belt, close to the hilt of his sword so he could get to it quickly, watching the savage intently for any sudden moves. After following him for a short while, though, Giselle had to admit the man gave no appearance of having murder in mind. If anything, he looked curious, amused, and somewhat embarrassed. He kept slowing, staring up at the buildings around him, shaking his head, scratching his face, muttering under his breath. He would occasionally horrify passers-by by smiling at them, but he seemed to present no greater threat, and Giselle began to relax, at least until they reached the square of marshals. The Northman stopped suddenly. Giselle fumbled for his sword, but the primitive's eyes were locked ahead, gazing at a fountain nearby. He moved slowly towards it, then cautiously raised a thick finger and poked at the glittering jet. Water splashed into his face, and he blundered away, almost knocking Giselle down.
"A spring," he whispered. "But how?"
Mercy, the man was like a child, a 6.5-foot child with a face like a butcher's block.
"There are pipes,"
Giselle stamped on the paving.
"Beneath the ground."
"Pipes," echoed the primitive quietly, staring at the frothing water. The others had moved some way ahead, close to the grand building in which Hoff had his offices. Giselle began to step away from the fountain, hoping to draw the witless savage with him. To Giselle's relief, he followed, shaking his head and muttering pipes to himself over and over. They entered the cool darkness of the Lord Chamberlain's anteroom. There were people seated on the benches around the walls, some of them giving the impression of having been waiting a very long time. They all stared as Morrow ushered the peculiar group straight into Hoff's offices. The spectacled secretary opened the heavy double doors and stood by, while first the old bald man, then his crony with the stick, then the madman Sulphur, and finally the nine-fingered primitive walked in past him. Giselle made to follow them, but Morrow stood in the doorway and blocked his path.
"Thank you so much for your help, Captain," he said with a thin smile. "You may return to the gate."
Giselle peered over his shoulder into the room beyond. He saw the Lord Chamberlain frowning behind a long table. Archlector Salt was beside him, grim and suspicious. High Justice Morovia was there too, a smile on his wrinkled face. Three members of the closed council. Then Morrow shut the door in his face. Chapter 25. Next. "I notice you have a new secretary," said Glockter, as though just in passing. The Archlector smiled.
"Of course, the old one was not to my liking. He had a loose tongue, you know."
Glockter paused, his wine glass halfway to his mouth.
"He had been passing our secrets on to the Mercers," continued Salt carelessly, as if it was common knowledge. "I had been aware of it for some time. You needn't worry, though. He never learned anything I didn't want him to know."
"Then you knew who our traitor was. You knew all along."
Glockter's mind turned the events of the last few weeks around, pulled them apart and put them back together in this new light, trying them different ways until they fit, all the while struggling to conceal his surprise.
"You left Rue's confession where you knew your secretary would see it. You knew the Mercers would find out who was on the list, and you guessed what they would do, knowing it would only play into your hands and give you the shovel with which to bury them. Meanwhile, you steered my suspicions towards Kayline, when you knew who the leak was all along. The whole business unfolded precisely according to your plan."
The Archlector was looking back at him with a knowing smile.
"And I bet you guess what I'm thinking right now. I have been almost as much a piece in this game as that snivelling worm of a secretary."
Glockter stifled a giggle.
"How fortunate for me that I was a piece on the right side. I never suspected a thing."
"He betrayed us for a disappointingly small sum of money," continued Salt, his lip curling with distaste. "I dare say Colt would have given him 10 times as much if he had only had the wit to ask. The younger generation really have no ambition. They think they're a great deal cleverer than they are."
He studied Glockter with his cool blue eyes.
"I am part of the younger generation, more or less. I am justly humbled."
"Your secretary hath been disciplined?"
The Archlector placed his glass carefully down on the tabletop, the base barely making a sound on the wood.
"Oh, yes, most severely. It really isn't necessary to spare him any further thought."
"I bet it isn't. Body found floating by the docks."
"I must say, I was greatly surprised when you fixed on Superior Kayline as the source of our leak. The man was from the old guard. A few indulgences to look the other way over trifling matters, of course, but to betray the Inquisition? To sell our secrets to the Mercers?"
Salt snorted.
"Never! You allowed your personal dislike for the man to cloud your judgment."
"He seemed the only possibility,"
muttered Glockter, but immediately regretted it.
"Foolish, foolish, the mistake is made. Better just to keep your mouth shut."
"Seemed?"
The Archlector clicked his tongue in profound disapproval.
"No, no, no, Inquisitor. Seemed is not good enough for us. In future, we'll have just the facts, if you please. But don't feel too badly about it. I allowed you to follow your instincts, and, as things have turned out, your blunder has left our position much the stronger. Kayline has been removed from office."
"Body found floating.
and Superior Goyle is on his way from Angland to assume the role of Superior of Adjua.
Goyle? Coming here? That bastard, the new Superior of Adjua? Glockter could not prevent his lip from curling.
The two of you are not the greatest of friends, eh, Glockter?
He is a jailer, not an investigator. He is not interested in guilt or innocence. He is not interested in truth. He tortures for the thrill of it.
Oh, come now, Glockter. Are you telling me you feel no thrill when your prisoners spill their secrets? When they name the names? When they sign the confession?
I take no pleasure in it. I take no pleasure in anything.
And yet you do it so very well. In any case, Goyle is coming, and whatever you may think of him, he is one of us. A most capable and trustworthy man, dedicated to the service of crown and state. He was once a pupil of mine, you know.
Really?
Yes, he had your job. So there is some future in it, after all.
The Archlector giggled at his own joke. Glockter gave a thin smile of his own.
All in all, things have worked out very nicely, and you are to be congratulated on your part in it. A job well done.
Well enough done that I am still alive, at least.
Salt raised his glass, and they drank a joyless toast together, eyeing each other suspiciously over the rims of their glasses. Glockter cleared his throat.
Magister Colt mentioned something interesting before his unfortunate demise.
Go on.
The Mercers had a partner in their schemes. A senior partner, perhaps. A bank.
Ah, turn a merchant over and there's always a banker underneath. What of it?
I believe these bankers knew about it all. The smuggling, the fraud, the murders, even. I believe they encouraged it, maybe ordered it, so that they could get a good return on their loans. May I begin an investigation, Your Eminence?
Which bank?
Valent and Bulk.
The Archlector seemed to consider a moment, staring at Glockter through his hard blue eyes.
Does he already know about these particular bankers? Does he already know much more than me? What did Colt say? You want traitors, Glockter? Look in the House of Questions.
No, snapped Salt. Those particular bankers are well connected. They are owed too many favours, and without Colt it would be difficult to prove anything. We got what we needed from the Mercers, and I have a more pressing task for you.
Glockter looked up. Another task.
I was looking forward to interviewing the prisoners we took at the Guildhall, Your Eminence. It may be that—
No!
The Archlector swatted Glockter's words away with his gloved hand.
That business could drag on for months. I will have Goyle handle it.
He frowned.
Unless you object.
So I plough the field, sow the seed, water the crop, then Goyle reaps the harvest. Some justice.
He humbly bowed his head.
Of course not, Your Eminence.
Good. You're probably aware of the unusual visitors we received yesterday.
Visitors? For the past week, Glockter had been in agony with his back. Yesterday, he had struggled out of bed to watch that cretin Luthar fence, but otherwise he had been confined to his tiny room, virtually unable to move.
I hadn't noticed, he said simply.
Byers, the first of the Magi.
Glockter gave his thin smile again, but the Archlector was not laughing.
You're joking, of course.
If only.
A charlatan, Your Eminence?
What else? But a most extraordinary one. Lucid, reasonable, clever. The deception is elaborate in the extreme.
You have spoken with him?
I have. He is remarkably convincing. He knows things. Things he shouldn't know. He cannot be simply dismissed. Whoever he is, he has funding and good sources of information.
The Archlector frowned deep.
He has some renegade brute of a Northman with him.
Glockter frowned.
A Northman? It hardly seems their style.
They strike me as most direct.
My very thoughts.
A spy for the Emperor, then? The Gurkish?
Perhaps. The Cantiques love a good intrigue, but they tend to stick to the shadows. These theatricals don't seem to have their mark. I suspect our answer may lie closer to home.
The nobles, Your Eminence? Brock, Isher, Huygen?
Perhaps, mused Salt. Perhaps. They're annoyed enough. Or there's our old friend the High Justice. He seemed a little too pleased about it all. He's plotting something, I can tell.
The nobles, the High Justice, the Northmen, the Gurkish. It could be any one of them, or none. But why? I don't understand, Archlector. If they are simply spies, why go to all this trouble? Surely there are easier ways to get into the Agriant.
This is the thing.
Salt gave as bitter a grimace as Glockter had ever seen.
There is an empty seat on the closed council. There always has been. A pointless tradition, a matter of etiquette. A chair reserved for a mythical figure. In any case, dead for hundreds of years. Nobody ever supposed that anyone would come forward to claim it.
But he has?
He has! He has demanded it!
The Archlector got to his feet and strode around the table.
I know! Unthinkable! Some spy, some liar from who knows where, privy to the workings of the very heart of our government. But he has some dusty papers, so it falls to us to discredit him. Can you believe it?
Glockter could not. But there hardly seems any purpose to saying so.
I have asked for time to investigate, continued Salt. But the closed council will not be put off indefinitely. We have only a week or two to expose this so-called Magus for the fraud he is. In the meantime, he and his companions are making themselves at home in an excellent suite of rooms in the Tower of Chains, and there is nothing we can do to prevent them wandering the Agriant, causing whatever mischief they please.
There is something we could do. The Tower of Chains is very high. If somebody were to fall...
No, not yet. We've already pushed our luck as far as it will go in certain circles. For the time being, at least, we must tread carefully.
There is always the possibility of an interrogation. If we were to arrest them, I could soon find out who they're working for.
Tread carefully, I said. I want you to look into this Magus, Glockter, and his companions. Find out who they are, where they come from, what they're after. Above all, find out who is behind them and why. We must discredit this would-be Byers before he can do any damage. After that, you can use whatever means you please.
Salt turned and moved away to the window. Glockter got up awkwardly, painfully, from his chair. How shall I begin?
Follow them, shouted the Archlector impatiently. Watch them. See who they speak to, what they're about. You're the Inquisitor, Glockter, he snapped, without even looking round. Ask some questions!
Chapter 26 Better Than Death.
We're looking for a woman, said the officer, staring at them suspiciously. An escaped slave, a killer, very dangerous.
A woman, master?
Asked Yulwe, his brow wrinkled with confusion.
Dangerous, master.
Yes, a woman.
The officer waved his hand impatiently.
Tall, with a scar, hair cropped short, well armed, most likely with a bow.
Pharaoh stood there, tall and scarred, hair cropped short, bow over her shoulder, and looked down at the dusty ground.
She is wanted by the highest of authorities, a thief and a murderer many times over.
Yulwe gave a humble smile and spread his hands.
We have seen no such person, master. I and my son are unarmed, as you can see.
Pharaoh looked down uncomfortably at the curved blade of the sword stuck through her belt, shining in the bright sun. The officer didn't seem to notice, though. He swatted at a fly
as Yulwe blathered on.
"Neither one of us would know what to do with such a thing as a bow, I can assure you. We trust in God to protect us, Master, and in the Emperor's matchless soldiers."
The officer snorted.
"Very wise, old man. What's your business here?"
"I am a merchant, on my way to Dugaska to purchase spices."
And he gave a grovelling bow.
"With your kind permission."
"Trading with the Pinks, are you? Damn Union."
The officer spat in the dust.
"Still, a man has to make a living, I suppose, if a shameful one. Trade while you can. The Pinks will be gone soon, swept back into the ocean."
He puffed out his chest with pride.
"The Emperor, Uthman ul-Dosht, has sworn it. What do you think of that, old man?"
"Oh, it will be a great day, a great day,"
said Yulwe, bowing low again.
"May God bring it to us soon, Master."
The officer looked Pharaoh up and down.
"Your son looks a strong lad. Perhaps he'd make a soldier."
He took a step towards her and grabbed hold of her bare arm.
"That's a strong arm. That arm could draw a bow, I'd say, if it were taught. What do you say, boy? A man's work, fighting for the glory of God and your emperor. Better than grubbing for a pittance."
Pharaoh's flesh crawled where his fingers touched her skin. Her other hand crept towards her knife.
"Alas," said Yulwe quickly, "my son was born simple. He scarcely speaks."
"Ah, a shame. The time may come when we need every man. Savages they may be, but these Pinks can fight."
The officer turned away, and Pharaoh scowled after him.
"Very well, you may go."
He waved them on. The eyes of his soldiers, lounging in the shade of the palms around the road, followed them as they walked past, but without much interest. Pharaoh held her tongue until the encampment had dwindled into the distance behind them. Then she rounded on Yulwe.
"Dugaska?"
"To begin with,"
said the old man, staring off across the scrubby plain.
"And then north."
"North?"
"Across the Circle Sea to Adua."
"Across the sea?" She stopped in the road.
"I'm not fucking going there."
"Must you make everything so difficult, Pharaoh? Are you that happy here in Gurkul?"
"These northerners are mad. Everyone knows it. Pinks, Union, or whatever. Mad. Godless."
Yulwe raised an eyebrow at her.
"I didn't know you were so interested in God, Pharaoh."
"At least I know there is one,"
she shouted, pointing at the sky.
"These Pinks, they don't think like us, like real people. We've no business with their kind. I'd rather stay among the Gurkish. Besides, I've scores to settle here."
"What scores? Going to kill Uthman?"
She frowned.
"Perhaps I will."
"Ha!"
Yulwe turned and headed off up the road.
"They're looking for you, Pharaoh, in case you hadn't noticed. You wouldn't get 10 strides without my help. They've still got that cage waiting, remember? The one in front of the palace? They are anxious to fill it."
Pharaoh ground her teeth.
"Uthman is the emperor now. Ul-Dosht, they call him. The mighty, the merciless. Greatest emperor for 100 years, they are saying already. Kill the emperor?"
Yulwe chuckled to himself.
"You're quite a character, all right. Quite a character."
Pharaoh scowled as she followed the old man up the hill. She wasn't looking to be anyone's character. Yulwe could make these soldiers see whatever he pleased, and that was a smart trick, but she'd be damned if she was going north. What business did she have with those godless Pinks? Yulwe was still chuckling away as she drew level with him.
"Kill the Emperor."
He shook his head.
"He'll just have to wait until you get back. You owe me, remember?"
Pharaoh grabbed him by the sinewy arm.
"I don't remember you saying anything about crossing the sea."
"I don't remember your asking, Mal'jin. And you should be glad you didn't."
He peeled her fingers gently away.
"Your corpse might be drying nicely in the desert, instead of grumbling in my ear, all sleek and healthy. Think on that a while.
That shut her up for the time being. She walked along in silence, scowling out across the scrubby landscape, sandals crunching on the dry dirt of the road. She looked sidelong at the old man. He'd saved her life with his tricks. That couldn't be denied. But she'd be damned if she was going north. The fortress was concealed in a rocky cove, but from where they were, high up on the bluff with the fierce sun behind them, Ferro could see the shape of it well enough. A high wall enclosed neat rows of buildings, enough to make a small town. Next to them, built out into the water, were long wharves. Moored to the wharves were ships. Huge ships. Towers of wood. Floating fortresses. Ferro had never seen ships half that size. Their masts were a dark forest against the bright water behind. 10 were docked below them, and further out in the bay, 2 more were cutting slowly through the waves, great sails billowing, tiny figures crawling on the decks, and in amongst the spiders' webs of ropes above.
"I see 12, murmured Yulway. "But your eyes are the sharper."
Ferro looked out across the water. Further round the curving shore, 20 miles away perhaps, she could see another fortress, another set of wharves.
"There are more over there," she said. 8 or 9, and those ones are bigger."
"Bigger than these?"
"A lot bigger."
"God's breath," muttered Yulway to himself. "The Gurkish never built ships so big before. Not half so big. Nor half so many. There is not the wood in all the south for such a fleet. They must have bought it from the north, from the Styrians, maybe."
Ferro cared nothing for boats or wood or the north.
"So?"
"With a fleet this size, the Gurkish will be a power at sea. They could take Dagoska from the bay, invade Westport even."
The pointless names of faraway places.
"So?"
"You don't understand, Ferro. I must warn the others. We must make haste now."
He pushed himself up from the ground and hurried back towards the road. Ferro grunted. She watched the big wooden tubs moving back and forth in the bay for a moment longer, then she got up and followed Yulway. Great ships or tiny ships, it meant nothing to her. The Gurkish could take all the Pinks in the world for slaves, as far as she was concerned. If that meant they left the real people alone.
"Out of the way!"
The soldier spurred his horse right at them, raising his whip.
"A 1,000 pardons, master,"
whined Yulway, grovelling to the ground, scuttling off into the grass beside the road, pulling Ferro reluctantly by the elbow. She stood in the scrub, watching the column shamble slowly by. Thin figures, ragged, dirty, vacant, hands bound tightly, hollow eyes on the ground. Men and women, all ages, children even, 100 or more. 6 guards rode alongside them, easy in their tall saddles, whips rolled up in their hands.
"Slaves."
Ferro licked her dry lips.
"The people of Kadir have risen up,"
said Yulway, frowning at the miserable procession.
"They wished no longer to be part of the glorious nation of Gurkul, and thought the death of the Emperor might be their chance to leave. It seems they were wrong. The new Emperor is harder even than the last, eh, Ferro? Their rebellion has failed already. It seems your friend Uthman has taken slaves as punishment."
Ferro watched a scrawny girl limping slowly, bare feet trailing in the dust. 13 years old? It was hard to tell. Her face was dirty and listless. There was a scabby cut across her forehead, others on the back of her arm. Whip marks. Ferro swallowed, watched the girl toiling along. An old man, just in front of her, tripped and sprawled face first into the road, making the whole column stumble to a halt.
"Move!" barked one of the riders, spurring his horse forward. "On your feet!"
The old man struggled in the dust.
"Move!"
The soldier's whip cracked, leaving a long red mark across the man's scrawny back.
Ferro twitched and winced at the sound, and her back began to tingle, where the scars were, almost as if she'd been whipped herself. No one whips Ferro Mal'Jin and lives. Not anymore. She shrugged the bow off her shoulder.
"Peace, Ferro,"
hissed Yulwe, grabbing her by the arm.
"There's nothing you can do for them."
The girl bent down, helping the old slave to his feet. The whip cracked again, catching them both, and there was a yelp of pain. Was it the girl or the man who had cried out? Or had it been Ferro herself? She shook Yulwe's hand off, reaching for an arrow.
"I can kill this bastard,"
she snarled. The soldier's head snapped round to look at them, curious. Yulwe seized hold of her hand.
"What then?" he hissed. "If you killed all six of them, what then? Have you food and water for 100 slaves, eh? You have it well concealed. And when the column is missed, eh? And their guards found slaughtered? What then, killer? Will you hide 100 slaves out here? Because I cannot."
Ferro stared into Yulwe's black eyes, her teeth grinding together, her breath snorting fast through her nose. She wondered whether or not to try and kill him again. No. He was right, damn him. Slowly, she pushed the anger back, as far down as it would go. She shoved the arrow away and turned back towards the column. She watched the old slave stumble on, and the girl after him, fury gnawing at her guts like hunger. "You!" called the soldier, nudging his horse over towards them.
"You've done it now,"
hissed Yulwe. Then he bowed to the guard, smiling, scraping.
"My apologies, master. My son is..."
"Shut your mouth, old man!"
The soldier looked down at Ferro from his saddle. "Well, boy, do you like her?"
"What?"
she hissed through gritted teeth.
"No need to be shy," chuckled the soldier. "I've seen you looking."
He turned towards the column.
"Hold them up there!"
he shouted, and the slave stumbled to a halt. He leaned from his saddle and grabbed the scrawny girl under the armpit, dragging her roughly out of the column.
"She's a good one," he said, pulling her towards Ferro. "Bit young, but she's ready. Clean up nice, she will. Bit of a limp, but that'll heal. We've been driving them hard. Good teeth. Show 'em your teeth, bitch."
The girl's cracked lips curled back slowly.
"Good teeth. What do you say, boy? 10 in gold for her. It's a good price."
Ferro stood there, staring. The girl looked dumbly back with big, dead eyes.
"Look," said the soldier, leaning down from his saddle. "She's worth twice that, and there's no danger in it. When we get to Shaffa, I'll tell them she died out here in the dust. No one will wonder at that. It happens all the time. I get 10, and you save 10. Everyone wins."
Everyone wins. Ferro stared up at the guard. He pulled his helmet off, wiped his forehead with the back of his hand.
"Peace, Ferro," whispered Yulwe.
"All right, 8, shouted the soldier. "She's got a nice smile. Show him a smile, bitch."
The corner of the girl's mouth twitched slightly.
"There, see? 8, and you're stealing from me."
Pharaoh's fists were clenched, nails digging into her palms.
"Peace, Ferro,"
whispered Yulwe, with a warning note in his voice.
"God's teeth, but you drive a bargain, boy. 7, and that's my last offer. 7, damn it!"
The soldier waved his helmet around in frustration.
"Use her gently. In 5 years she'll be worth more. It's an investment."
The soldier's face was just a few feet away. She could see each tiny bead of sweat forming on his forehead, each stubbly hair on his cheeks, each blemish, nick and pore on his skin. She could smell him almost. The truly thirsty will drink piss or salt water or oil, however bad for them, so great is their need to drink. Ferro had seen it often in the Badlands. That was the extent of her need to kill this man now. She wanted to tear him with her bare hands, to choke the life from him, to rip his face with her teeth. The desire was almost too strong to resist.
"Peace,"
hissed Yulwe.
"I can't afford her," Ferro heard herself saying. "You might have said so before, boy, and saved me the trouble,"
The soldier stuck his helmet back on. So, I can't blame you for looking. She's a good one. He reached down and grabbed the girl under the arm, dragging her back towards the others. They'll get 24er in Shaffa, he shouted over his shoulder. The column moved on. Pharaoh watched the girl until the slaves disappeared over a rise, stumbling, limping, shambling towards slavery. She felt cold now, cold and empty. She wished she had killed the guard, whatever the cost. Killing him could have filled that empty space, if only for a while. That was how it worked.
I walked in a column like that, she said slowly.
Yulwe gave a long sigh.
I know, Pharaoh, I know. But fate has chosen you for saving. Be grateful for it, if you know how.
You should have let me kill him.
Ah!
Clucked the old man in disgust.
I do declare you'd kill the whole world if you could. Is there anything but killing in you, Pharaoh?
There used to be, she muttered.
But they whip it out of you. They whip you until they're sure there's nothing left.
Yulwe stood there with that pitying look on his face. Strange how it didn't make her angry anymore.
I'm sorry, Pharaoh. Sorry for you and for them.
He stepped back into the road, shaking his head.
But it's better than death.
She stayed for a moment, watching the dust rising from the distant column.
The same, she whispered to herself.
Chapter 27 Sore Thumb. Logan leaned against the parapet, squinted into the morning sun, and took in the view. He'd done the same, it felt long ago now, from the balcony of his room at the library. The two views could hardly have been more different. Sunrise over the jagged carpet of buildings on the one hand, hot and glaring bright and full of distant noise. The cold and misty valley on the other, soft and empty and still as death. He remembered that morning, remembered how he'd felt like a different man. He certainly felt a different man now, a stupid man, small, scared, ugly, and confused.
Logan?
Malachus stepped out onto the balcony to stand beside him, smiled up at the sun and out over the city to the sparkling bay, already busy with ships.
Beautiful, isn't it?
If you say so. But I'm not sure I see it.
All those people.
Logan gave a sweaty shiver.
It's not right. It frightens me.
Frightened? You?
Always.
Logan had barely slept since they arrived. It was never properly dark here, never properly quiet. It was too hot, too close, too stinking. Enemies might be terrifying, but enemies could be fought and put an end to. Logan could understand their hatred. There was no fighting the faceless, careless, rumbling city. It hated everything.
This is no place for me. I'll be glad to leave.
We might not be leaving for a while.
I know.
Logan took a deep breath.
That's why I'm going to go down and look at this Agriont and find out what I can about it. Some things have to be done. It's better to do them than to live with the fear of them. That's what my father used to tell me.
Good advice. I'll come with you.
You will not.
Baez was in the doorway, glaring out at his apprentice.
Your progress over the last few weeks has been a disgrace, even for you.
He stepped through into the open air.
I suggest that while we are idle, waiting on His Majesty's pleasure, you should take the opportunity to study. Another such chance may be a long time coming.
Malachus hurried back inside with no backward glances. He knew better than to dawdle with his master in this mood. Baez had lost all his good humour as soon as they arrived at the Agriont, and it didn't look like coming back. Logan could hardly blame him. They'd been treated more like prisoners than guests. He didn't know much about manners, but he could guess the meaning of hard stares from everyone and guards outside the door.
"You wouldn't believe how it's grown," growled Byers, frowning out at the great sweep of sea.